Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to today's Bidder Information webcast. This is the webcast related to the Fall 2022 Index REC RFP for the procurement of RECs from utility scale wind, utility scale solar, and brownfield site photovoltaic projects. Joining with me today and presenting is Mr. Anthony Starr from the Illinois Power Agency, as well as Ms. Katie Olandi from NERA. My name is Benjamin Chi. I'm with NERA, and NERA is the procurement administrator on behalf of the Illinois Power Agency for this RFP. A few housekeeping items from this cover slide. You'll see some of the logos here at the bottom, and this procurement is for the procurement of RECs for the IPA's portfolio of these utilities that you find here, Ameren Illinois Company, or what we will call AIC for short. We have the Commonwealth Edison Company, or ComEd, as well as MEC, or Mid-American Energy Company. These are the names that you will see recurring in some of the slides going forward, and these are also what we call companies collectively throughout the presentation. So on this slide two, we have a housekeeping item. Do not worry about taking notes. For today's presentation, the presentation itself, as well as the audio recording, will be posted to the RFP website. You'll find the procurement website here at the bottom of slide two, ipa-energyrfp.com. You can ask your questions at any point in time during the presentation if something is unclear. And you can simply locate the chat icon at the bottom of your screen. Click on that. There should be a pop-up that shows up on the right. Type in your questions, reference any slide numbers, and then you can submit your questions to the presenters for today's session. We have a disclaimer here on slide three. So this procurement is pursuant to the CEJA, or what we have here as Public Act 1020662. And this is also pursuant to the IPA's 2022 Long-Term Renewable Resources Procurement Plan that has been approved by the Illinois Commerce Commission in docket number 22-0231. So the governing documents will include the Public Act as well as the FALC plan as approved by the Commission, the Commission's order in this docket, as well as the final RFP rules and the final contract that have been posted as of Friday, October 7th. And so you as the bidders can find the documents on our procurement website. The link is provided at the bottom of this slide three, and you will bear the full responsibility for reviewing and understanding these documents. So any statements that we make on this call describing or referring to the governing documents, including the RFP or the contract itself, they are summaries only, and they are qualified in their entirety by reference to these documents. A few things to note for you in terms of the posted documents. I have noted a few times now about the procurement website. Again, the procurement website is found on the top of this slide for ipa-energyrfp.com. Once you're there, you should see the IPA's logo at the top. And if you scroll to the left navigation bar will list some of the ongoing procurements that we have, including this particular RFP. And for this RFP, you have to find the link that is entitled Index Wind, Solar, or Brownfield. Once you click there, there should be a couple of sublinks that will pop up. And one of them will show up as the final materials page or link. You click there, you'll get to the documents that were posted recently on October 7, including the RFP rules as well as the contract. One word as well, we have not only the contract, but also posted a couple of red lines that you can compare if you're a returning bidder, if you want to see what has changed relative to what you have seen before. The red lines could be quite helpful in that regard. In terms of the agenda for today, we have quite a full deck, and the slides that we have today is about 85 slides long, so you can plan your time. We have allocated about 2 hours for the presentation and then to go over some of the steps in the RFP process, but also leaving some time for Q&A. So please ask your questions along the way. Agenda for today will cover the background and context for this RFP, and then provide you a very high-level overview of the entire RFP and what you can expect in terms of the requirements. And then we will walk you through the terms of the transaction, what you'll be signing on to if you are selected as a winner with a winning project, by going through some of the key terms and conditions of the supplier contract. We will then spend the latter part of the presentation just on the practical aspects of your participation, talking about timeline, requirements, how you submit your qualification submissions to us, and then also what is a bid in this process, how to submit your bid, and the post-bid process. So with that, I would like to turn the time to Mr. Anthony Starr from the IPA.
Great, thank you, Mr. Chi. So I will just provide a quick high-level overview of the background that got us to the point we are today of beginning the process for this fall 2022 index direct procurement. So while the Illinois Power Agency has been doing a variety of procurements of RECs for many years, and in particular coming out of the Future Energy Jobs Act, the legislation that was passed in 2016, and took effect in 2017, we did a number of procurements for RECs from new utility scale wind, solar, and brownfield site photovoltaic projects. As I suspect everyone on today's webcast is quite familiar with, the Climate and Equitable Jobs Act was enacted about a year ago and made a wide range of changes to the ways in which the Illinois Power Agency implements the Renewable Portfolio Standard, including the change to the procurements we do to procure RECs from utility scale projects to shift from a fixed REC model to an indexed REC price model. In terms of the process of where we got there, I'll talk in a moment about a procurement that was mandated by that law that we conducted earlier this year outside of our regular planning process. Today's procurement is the first procurement that is flowing out of what is known as our long-term renewable resources procurement plan, the 2022 version of that plan, which is the version that is updated to include the provisions of CEJA. We had a process by which we filed a plan with the Illinois Commerce Commission in March of this year, and it was approved in July, and we finalized that plan in August. So that plan calls for this procurement of RECs from utility scale projects, and this will be the first, as I said, the first procurement under this new plan, though it does build upon the previous procurement that we held earlier in the year. One note is that according to the 2022 long-term plan, we also are scheduled to conduct a second procurement under this new model in, I believe it's late spring or early summer of next year. And then going forward from that, we will be doing a new version of the plan next summer, releasing for public comment that would guide our procurements for 2024 and 2025. So we have a two-year updating cycle, but the goal really is to have each procurement sort of build on and refine from the previous ones. Next slide, please. So we held a procurement in the spring of this year that was our first procurement under the indexed rec model. This was mandated, as I mentioned, by the changes to the IPA Act included in CEJA to really sort of start moving things forward with procurement of RECs while we were going through the long and complex process of updating our long-term plan, which is our greater guidance document for how we manage the RPS. That procurement was held in May. Included on this slide are the targets we had, as well as the average winning price. Again, that is sort of the strike price. Mr. Chi will be going into more detail later about what the number represents in terms of the overall sort of value of the renewable energy credits. The targets we had that are listed at the top of the slide, we did not meet in that spring procurement. And one of the things we did to prepare for the adjustments for this procurement was not only were there the specific things that were developed through the long-term plan that were implementation-specific aspects of CEJA, but we also tried to understand better what were some of the barriers to participation for the spring procurement. And where possible, we've made adjustments to the procurement process and the contract to accommodate those. There are certain stakeholder feedback we were not able to accommodate because of either statutory or other requirements, but where possible, we were trying to recognize the significant changes that come from the indexed rec procurement process and what we can do to really make sure that this is as successful as possible going forward. If you would like to see any of the information from the workshops we held or written comments received, they're available on the link listed at the bottom of the slide. So with that, that sets the context up for where we are now with this specific procurement going forward for index RECs. And with that, I will pass the microphone back to Mr. Chi.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Starr. So on the heels of what Mr. Starr just explained, about the workshop, we have held two rounds of written comments since the workshop on the contract as well as the preliminary proposal requirements that led up to finalize both the final RFP documents, including the final contract. The timeline is provided here, but the key item here for you to know, there are two of them. First is that all of the written comments from the first two rounds have been posted on our website. You can find them by clicking the link when this presentation is posted. But also the part one window opens tomorrow. And I will explain what that means. There is a two-part application process preceding bid submission. So in terms of the final contracts, again, those were the ones posted on October 7th, the final contract, as well as the RFP documents. So for key changes, I'm not going to go through every single change in the contract. As I mentioned earlier, there is a red line that you can find that shows you the changes relative to the first draft contract that was posted for comments, as well as the a red line showing the changes from the spring procurement. We have made a couple of enhancements, introduced some flexibility and clarifications to the process. But here are the big ones, and I will go through some of these a little later as well in more depth. But these will include the minimum equity standard that was brought in pursuant to the IPA's 2022 long-term plan. We are mandating that the standard to be 10% that will apply to projects participating or be awarded in this fall 2022 procurement. There are a couple of exceptions, and I will talk to that when we get to the later sections. There will be some priority or preferences within the RFP that we'll go over when we have proposals that come in that are committing to an equity percent greater than the minimum equity standard, meaning that if you are proposing, this is optional, if you're proposing to have equity standards above the 10% minimum equity standard, then there will be some bid evaluation, ranking, and prioritization that will prioritize your projects. And that will occur by way of some strike price reduction when we do the bid ranking, just for purposes of bid ranking. And we will cover that in more depth later on as well. A couple of you have asked during the comment process for something called a bias fraction. This concept has been introduced in the latest contract, and it really is introduced by way of this term called the RFP project percentage. It's accomplished by at least two, it accomplishes the bias fraction in at least two ways. One is that you get to name how much of your project percentage you would like to commit to this RFP and to the utility counterparties of the contract. And any percentage that is not part of this RFP project percentage that you indicate will allow you to find other off-takers for your project's output and RECs. They do not belong to this procurement. Once you set it, you cannot change it for the term of this contract. And importantly, we have also removed one of the representations in the contract that prohibits you to sell or withhold RECs when you're in a shortfall year. That representation has been taken out. Effectively, what it means is that the utility counterparty of the contract no longer have first rights to your RECs. They only have the RECs that are tied to the RFP project percentage that you indicate through this RFP. This allows you to find other off-takers, but the rest of the contract structure still stands and are in place in terms of your delivery obligations. You will still need to name an annual delivery quantity that we're going to hold you to during the term of the RFP. There will be a standing order put in place that will be based on the RFP project percentage that you name and indicate in the RFP process, and that will be used to set with GETS and MRETs how many RECs are to be transferred during the delivery term. We have also made other changes and clarifications that you'll find in the red line that is provided online, including a more clear process for the return of RECs if the utility buyer cannot pay you for your RECs. And there is some clarification tied to that related to how if you owe money to the utility buyer, they will net against those RECs and count it as payment before the process kicks in for the return of RECs that cannot be paid. So any RECs that they are not able to pay you for, they will return back to you under the terms of the agreement. I will now jump right into high-level overview of the RFP process itself and then go into a deep dive on some of the contract elements. So a couple of highlights here on this slide. First, the bid date, take note, it's on December the 9th of this year. And we have these targets that are listed here, 1.75 million RECs annually from utility scale wind projects. We have 1 million RECs annually from utility scale projects. These are solar projects. And then we have 65,000 RECs to be delivered annually from these brownfield site PV projects. The contract will feature an index REC structure where payment will either flow from buyer to seller or seller to buyer. The RECs must be from these winning projects that are proposed in this RFP. And because there are three utility counterparties, the allocation, there will be an allocation of your RECs, the annual quantity that you name in the RFP to be allocated to each of these counterparties. In terms of your bid, you'll be basically indicating to us a strike price on a dollar per megawatt hour basis. That is not what you'll be paid, but this is what will be used to compare against something called an index price, and the difference is what will be accounted for payment. There will be a quantity that you will name as part of your bid, this is what we call the full quantity in the RFP documents. It's just an annual number of recs that you're committing to. There is also a minimum quantity that we'll be asking you to provide as part of your bid. This is in the case where we have filled the target and that taking on another project, the marginal project, would cause the target to be exceeded. So at that point, we would award a seller that is willing to accept a partial award, something less than the full quantity. And that is the minimum quantity that you are indicating. We also will be asking you for the RFP project percentage so that we know the percentage of the project that you're committing to this RFP. With that, the last component to the bid is really for you to indicate the index hub, either the PGM NI hub, Northern Illinois hub, or the MISO Illinois hub as the index price trading hub. So we have a slide here on some of the project requirements, just talking about what it means to be a utility scale wind or solar project under the contract. So some of these information that you see here on this slide 13, you can find in section 2 of the REC contract itself. They replicate what is in the Illinois law. So to be considered a utility scale wind or solar project, the size of the project must be greater than 5 megawatts AC rating. They must be either located in Illinois or in a state adjacent to Illinois. And also, there are some additional eligibility requirements that are provided here as well for projects that could transmit over a HVDC transmission line that meets the criteria provided in the Act. But mainly for most of the projects that we're looking for, they are really just located in Illinois that meets the definition or adjacent, a state adjacent to Illinois that meets the public interest criteria. The project itself will be identified with by you in the proposal. 50% of the project must be located on the site that you identify and have secured. This must be new projects, which means that the date of first operation must be after June 1st, 2017. They must also be subject to a number of labor requirements, including the Project Labor Agreement Act requirements, the Prevailing Wage Act requirements, as well as the MES requirements that I just talked about earlier. If the project is a utility scale solar project, the law also requires that the project itself is installed by qualified persons, as these terms are, as the term itself is defined in the contract. This does not apply to wind projects. In terms of the brownfield site PV projects, I'll just cover a few things listed here. Most of the requirements you see here are almost identical to what you find for utility scale solar projects. And those are what you find at the bottom of this slide 14. But what makes the brownfield site PV projects what it is first, there are no size requirements set in law. They do not need to be above or greater than 5 megawatts in terms of size, but it does need to be located in Illinois and entirely contained within the brownfield site that you will identify, and it may be co-located with a greenfield project. You need to provide us documentation that demonstrate the site itself is indeed a brownfield site, and there's a definition for that in the contract, as well as explaining the rules. But basically, it's a site that is currently regulated by the US EPA or Illinois EPA under one of these four programs, or is located at a permanently closed coal mine site that meets certain applicable requirements. in terms of what we're buying and what we're not buying, to be very clear, we're not buying your project. We're just buying the racks from the project. So you keep the project, but what we will be transacting are the racks from your project. The racks must be racks from the project selected through this RFP. What it means is that we're not looking for replacement racks. They are not eligible under this procurement. The racks must include all the environmental attributes tied to the rack. They must be transferred via a standing order through GATS or MRATS in an unretired state and must allow the buyer counterparty to comply with the Illinois RPS. In terms of some of the date restrictions here, first I will talk about when the first rack must be delivered under the contract. The default date, the standard date is once you build the project, it must start to deliver racks by May 31st, 2027. However, you could have a grace period to extend that deadline. There are some of these extension provisions provided in the contract. And the common way is for an automatic extension of the first rack delivery to be pushed out to May 31st, 2029 with the payment of the increased collateral requirement. So you just have to post additional collateral requirement. You have the extension, and that is what we will collect as collateral requirement or performance assurance under the contract. It can be moved out even further for good cause as described in the contract. In terms of the vintage period that we are after, the earliest possible vintage period would be January of 2023. We're not accepting any racks that are of a vintage earlier than January 2023. And this is only particular for projects that perhaps have already been built and are operational after June 1st, 2017 to be considered new under CEJA. In terms of the RFP, there is a two-part application process or proposal process. Part one, we have the window of part one listed here that runs from October 13 all the way through November 3rd at noon. This is a noon central prevailing time. And then we have a part two process that runs from November 18 through noon on December 2nd. The big thing or the main thing to understand here is that the entire process is going to be done online. So the part one will be for you to respond to qualification requirements. You'll provide us contact information and some information about the bidder and the seller, and you will do so using the online part one form. There'll be some inserts for you to complete, basically documents you will download from our website. You'll fill out, print, sign, scan, and upload back to the online form or portal. And then the only thing that is outside of the online form is the payment of the bid participation fee to the Illinois Power Agency. And I'll talk about that in a couple of slides from here. The second item to note is on the part two proposal, you will also continue to use the online portal. We have an online part two form where you again download some of the inserts, upload them back on the portal, fill out some information online. And the only thing that is not done through the online platform is the payment or the submission of your bid assurance collateral to each of the companies separately, either through cash or letter of credit to AIC, Comet, or MEC. So once you have successfully participated in the part one and part two proposal process, it's then for us to receive your bids. Bid submission occurs in a bid window on the bid date, which is again on December the 9th. And here a few things to note. First, bids are submitted using a spreadsheet, and two is the bids spreadsheets that you will populate will be accepted by us and delivered by you through a transfer of your spreadsheet through a secure interface, so that we can receive your spreadsheet and we will provide some information or more information about the submission process in our part one notification when you successfully qualify as a bidder. In terms of bid evaluation, once we have received your bids, we will consider bids that meet or beat a confidential benchmark that we will develop in consultation with the procurement monitor and approved by the Illinois Commerce Commission. Only those bids that beat or meet the benchmark will be considered. We have also in place some bid evaluation price adjustments for projects that are proposing an equity level above the minimum of 10%. The reference here to the RFP rules is provided. It is in section 6.2.9 of the RFP. You can read about that. This is an optional process. You do not need to commit to anything higher than the minimum of 10% for all projects. But if you do so, you will be afforded some adjustment in terms of the bid ranking in a second step after we have filtered out bids that have met the confidential benchmark. And at that point, all bids will be evaluated on a price-only basis, and there will be an evaluation separate for wind, solar, and the brownfield projects. And then the last point here is just to be clear that the procurement administrator have decided that we are not engaging in any post-bid negotiations under this process. So I'll talk about fees that are associated with your participation, and some of you may have already paid this fee. The first type of fee is known as the bid participation fee. The requirement is $500. It is required for bidders that participate in the IPA procurement events. You pay this once and once only for all procurement events that are held in 2022. If you have already paid this fee before, you do not need to do so again as a bidder. This is tied to a bidder that has paid this fee in a prior procurement or solicitation in this calendar year. If you are participating for the first time, this fee of $500 is due to the IPA by noon on the part one date. There are two methods of payment. You can do this by ePay online or through ACH. And more information will be sent out to you if you email us with that request at illinois-rfp@nira.com. And to be very clear, we are no longer accepting physical paper check. The second type of fee that is going to be applicable is the supplier fees. This is paid not by the bidder, but by winning bidders or people with winning projects. The requirement will be confirmed to you no later than 2 business days prior to the bid date on December 7. That's when we're going to finalize the supplier fee and make the announcement. At this time, we are estimating this to be 30 cents per rec of the annual quantity that you'll be awarded. This is only, again, for winning projects. If you do not win, you do not pay this supplier fee. This is due by or within 7 business days of the ICC approval of the bid results, and this will be paid to the IPA. Now, a quick deep dive into some of the key contract elements. So the contract is posted on October 7, you'll find not just the posted contract, but a couple of red lines that may help you if you are looking for how the terms have changed relative to the prior contracts. I'm not going to touch on all of these sections, but I'm just going to pull out a couple. And I think also flag for you that the key requirements, you can find them In Article 2, dealing with, you know, the project requirements and the facility requirements. We have delivery obligations in Section 4, payment, in Section 5, that deals with payment as well as invoicing. Performance assurance requirements or collateral requirements are covered in Section 7. What will lead to an event of default are covered in Section 9. A couple of exhibits are also provided at the back of this long form agreement, including what you will be required to provide for us to fill out the product order, or sometimes called the transaction confirmation, the form of which is provided as Exhibit A. Contact information for buyer and seller will be in Exhibit B. You have a couple of those forms of the invoice as well as the letters of credit and guarantee forms that could be used under the terms of the contract in Exhibit E, and examples for how we calculate the delivery year requirements for your delivery obligations in Exhibit F. So the basics on this slide 22, this contract is between the seller who has the right to convey title and transfer the rights to buyer. The buyer in this case would be each of the companies, Ameren Illinois or AIC, Commonwealth Edison or ComEd, and then we have Mid-American Energy or MEC. So there's going to be three agreements to be signed if you win for your an award for your project. So you must be willing to sign the agreement with all three companies. The RECs from the winning projects are then allocated among these companies by us. There's not much you need to do there. We will handle the allocation, but you need to agree to sign the contracts with each of these companies. The contracts, once the allocation are set and the award is allocated across the companies, will be administered separately by each of the companies. And the again, payment is for RECs that are delivered only, and no payment is made for your energy or your capacity or for your installation. We talked a bit about the quantities that are allocated. This is kind of an example here on slide 23. Under the contract, you'll find something called the annual quantity and then a maximum contract quantity. They are different things, but they are related. So the maximum contract quantity is simply the annual quantity, multiply that by 20 years. The annual quantity under the contract really is an allocation of the RFP annual quantity that you bid in the RFP. Once they're allocated, these terms are dealt with separately by each of the utility counterparties. So if you win, for example, 100,000 RECs to be delivered annually at a strike price of $30, naming or indicating the MISO Illinois trading hub as your index hub, then these information will kind of be transferred over to each of the contracts. The only thing that will be allocated again is the annual quantity that you find in the contract to be a subset that will sum up collectively to be the annual quantity that you have bid in the RFP. You will be required to register your project with GATS or MRATS as the tracking system and to establish a standing order. The standing order will be based on a few things, but principally will reflect the portion of the RECs to be awarded to each of ComEd, Ameren, and Mid-American company. So when you name a RFP project percentage in the RFP process, we will use that in connection with the utility counterparty share of the awarded annual quantity. You'll find that more in detail in Section 2 of the REC contract about how we're going to set up the standing order. The earliest vintage that must be that is acceptable under the standing order would be January 2023. We're not accepting any RECs through the standing order for RECs that are earlier than this vintage period. You will initiate the standing order request within 30 days of the project's date of first operation, or if this project is already operational, already producing RECs, and is a project that is eligible under this process, meaning that it has been energized after June 1st of 2017, then the standing order must be established within 30 days of the first of the year, January 1st, 2023. In terms of the collateral requirement, this has not changed, but the way that we have dealt with the unsecured credit terms have, and I'll get to that. So in terms of the collateral requirement, we are looking for $4 times the annual quantity, subject to a minimum of $20,000. And for solar projects, that will be $10 times the annual quantity that you're awarded, subject to a minimum of $50,000. So these collateral requirements are collateral requirements under the specific contract with a utility counterparty. So when we talk about the annual quantity here, what we are really after is the annual quantity as allocated to the utility itself. So you would be paying different sums of money to different utility counterparties. And if your project is delayed for whatever reason, there is an automatic extension that could push your first REC delivery deadline out to May 31st, 29, by posting additional collateral, which is basically twice of the collateral requirement established as the standard. We do provide unsecured credit if you are relying on a guarantor that at least have an investment grade rating. And by that, we mean BBB minus with S&P or Fitch, and Baa3 above with Moody's. And the unsecured credit, or what we call the collateral threshold, is currently offered at $2.5 million to cover any exposure. The one change we did make to the contract for this fall procurement is that we are no longer downgrading the S&P issuance rating by one notch. So now, if you have a unsecured credit or issue rating, that will be the same, but you still need to meet the investment grade rating requirements under the contract. And any exposure above the collateral threshold or unsecured credit will be met with either a parental guarantee or a letter of credit. And you can find these standard forms as exhibits to the REC contract. In terms of delivery obligations, the initial delivery must occur by May 31st, 2027. You can extend that by posting additional collateral. And there could be extension on a case-by-case basis at the approval of the IPA upon a demonstration of good costs that are not attributable to you. And they could include things like delays outside your control in finalizing interconnection agreements or permits or installing these interconnection facilities, as well as any delays that could be caused by GATS or MRATs. And any extension beyond the first extension of May 31st, 2029 will be on a 6-month period at a time. It could be extended multiple times. And basically, if it extends up through May 31st of 2030, you as the seller have the right to request for the contract to be terminated and your collateral to be returned. If it extends beyond that to 2034, then the contract itself will be terminated and the collateral will be returned back to you if these are considered good cause extensions approved by the IPA. I'll talk about a note here on the time elements of the contract. So under the index rack contract, payment and pricing are tied to the vintage of your racks. So I'll cover two items here, the delivery term and the acceptable vintage period. The vintage period is basically tied to when the electric generation occurs for your project that gave rise to the racks that you're delivering. The earliest vintage month cannot be earlier than January 2023, and we're not accepting any racks of earlier vintages than January 23. Could be later, but not earlier. And whenever the project is operational, that will set what we call the earliest vintage month. The latest vintage month will be the 241st month after the earliest vintage month. That gives you a full 20 years for you to have within the acceptable vintage month plus an extra month in case your project is energized, not at the start of the month, and there's a stop month in there. So we allow for 241 months for the acceptable vintage period. The delivery term, when we are expecting delivery of your racks, when you can deliver your racks for payment, will be just tied to more or less the acceptable vintage month. But we have this period called the delivery term. It starts on the first day the racks are issued by GATS or MRATS. Note that when the racks are issued, then it starts the clock of the delivery term for all of the three utilities. And it will end on the last day of the third month after the acceptable vintage period. So once the acceptable vintage period has closed, we allow for at least three more months for you to turn the racks in through the standing order. So in terms of your obligations, there is not much that have changed here. The principal change from a prior solicitation that you may be used to is now the utilities do not have first rights to your racks. If you're short in a year, you do not need to represent that you are you're not withholding racks or not selling the racks elsewhere. You could have racks sold elsewhere to a third party through the standing order, which is based on the RFP project percentage that you indicate at the start of the RFP here before we enter into the contract. The delivery year requirement is a defined term under the contract. It reflects the annual quantity that must be met each year. For solar projects, the delivery requirement is subject to a degradation factor of 0.5%, but this is not for wind. And you will find that delivery schedule provided in the product order when the contract is executed. So the requirement is this. It's going to be based on the vintage of the racks. And if you fail to meet the delivery requirement for three or more times, doesn't need to be consecutive, and the shortfall amount relative to the delivery requirement exceeds the annual quantity, then it becomes an event of default and the contract will be terminated and the collateral requirement will be forfeited at that point in time. Having said that, the flexibility that we are affording is that for the first full year, as well as any stop year preceding the first full year, the shortfall requirements are waived. What it means is that there are no delivery requirements through the first full delivery year. In terms of the RECs that are not eligible for transfer or payment, they will belong to seller and they are your property to be used by you for in any way that you see fit. So there are a couple of ways in which RECs are not subject to payment. So first, RECs that are not transferred due to the RFP project percentage that you indicate in the RFP, those are sold or could be sold to other off-takers of your choice. We don't get those RECs through the standing order, and therefore those are not eligible for payment. There are wrecks that could be outside of the acceptable vintage period. If they shows up in the transfer, they are returned back to you. They are not eligible for payment. The delivery requirement also sets for us the budget for that year. Any wrecks that are in excess of the delivery requirement will also not be eligible for payment and be returned. And this will be based on the wreck vintage, not when the wrecks are actually delivered. And to be clear, if there is shortfall amounts, they cannot be satisfied with these ineligible or excess wrecks. If you have wrecks that have been transferred that are not eligible for payment, then we are asking seller to inform buyer to request for those wrecks to be returned within, and for you to request that within 60 days of such transfers. And if seller or other buyer fail to return wrecks that are that you have indicated for return, then they shall pay you for those wrecks in accordance with section 2.3F of the wreck contract. Payment and invoicing occurs on a monthly basis. There is a timeline tied to payments, but basically this is an index wreck payment. We will be looking for the megawatt hour generation at each hour during the term of the contract. And then we will also be comparing the strike price in your bids against the index price that you have indicated to be the index trading hub, the real-time price from either MISO Illinois or PJM NYHub. And we will compare those LMPs to the strike price to find out what the differences are. The price itself will be aggregated to become a monthly rack price. And this will be a weighted price, weighted by the production or megawatt hours in that month or in that hour, and aggregated across all hours in that month. If the price is positive, then you will pay buyer the invoice amount. If it is negative, then buyer will pay you the invoice amount. So the top part of this slide deals with how pricing occurs. As you know, invoice amounts or payment has two components. One is price, the other is volume or quantity. So this is how we set the price on this slide 32. And at the bottom of this slide 32, what we are indicating is that we are only paid for the recs that are delivered tied to those vintages. So you have a monthly price for a vintage month, and then we're counting number of recs that have been delivered via GETS or MRETs to indicate what the payment would be. Here is a timeline on slide 33. This is an example. If you have electricity produced in June of 23, we call that the vintage month. Within 5 business days, when the month closed, this would put us into July 10th of 23, for example, the 5th business day in July. You have to provide information. There's a reporting requirement under 6.1, section 6.1 of the REC contract for you to let us know what the generation data is for the month of June from your project. And we are looking for the entire generation of your project, not what is committed to buyer, not what is committed just for the RFP. We need this so that we can calculate what the REC price is. IPA is the one that will calculate this, and they will issue the notice to buyer and seller to confirm what the monthly REC price is for the vintage month of June. And they will do so by the 20th day of that month, July 20th in this case. Again, the calculation of the price is expected to occur even before the delivery of RECs. Delivery of RECs typically lags a month from the generation month. So anything that is based on electricity produced in June is expected to be delivered by GETS or MRETs on the last business day of July. So you'll get the price information from the IPA by July 20th. You will deliver the RECs into the buyer's account by July 31st. And then you are allowed and required to invoice buyer by August 10, the following month, when the RECs are actually delivered based on the price that you got from the IPA and the RECs that you have transferred via the standing order. And you will be paid by buyer or pay buyer as applicable by August 31st of 23. So end of the month in which the invoice is received. So as I said a few times now, this is an index rack pricing. So it's either, it could be either that you pay buyer or buyer pays you. And in either case, there is a requirement for you to invoice buyer regardless of whether the price is positive or negative. If the price is positive, you will be expected to pay the utility counterparty for the RECs, but you will also be allowed to request for an invoice for documentary purposes. And in this case, if you get a, in this case, you will see a price of negative $2.98 per REC. This is issued by the IPA and calculated by the IPA. Negative price means that you are expecting payment from the buyer counterparty. You multiply by the RECs that are transferred, 80 RECs in this case, and you will get an amount that will be invoiced to buyer for payment by buyer. You'll be paid by the end of the month in which the invoices are submitted and the contract itself in Article 5 has some requirements for invoicing and payment. I'll talk quickly about reporting requirements. There are a couple of them, and you'll find them all in Section 6 of the REC contract. First, reporting requirements tied to monthly generation. After the close of a vintage month, please provide the monthly generation report to under the contract. The IPA needs that for calculating the price. This will be the hourly real-time LMP at the applicable index hub, as well as the generation data at the project's keynote. We're looking for all of your generation, and you are also required to provide read-only access to buy any IPA so that they can verify the data for your generation in the PJM power meter system or MISO market portal as applicable. You are encouraged to do so quickly after the date of first operation has occurred so that we can ensure that we have the information ready to price the RECs for that vintage month. And so there will be no delays in getting your invoice out at the right price for payment. There are a couple of labor-related requirements, four of them that I'll cover here quickly. First, Prevailing Wage Act requirements. This is applicable to all projects throughout the contract term. As long as there is construction activities that occurs, you need to ensure that you are paying the general prevailing rate of hourly wages. You must provide documentation and verification to the IPA under the contract. The first report will be due 5 business days, either of the date of first operation, or if this project has already occurred, then 5 business days of the effective date of the agreement. And then throughout the contract term, if there is applicable work done, then we ask that you provide the IPA documentation and verification about your compliance with the PWA no later than July 15, following the end of the delivery year when there is construction activities going on. If you are a project outside of Illinois but is in an adjacent state, if they have a prevailing wage that is published, use that or use the federal Davis-Bacon rate if it is not available in order to comply with the Illinois PWA requirements. We're looking for wage parity here. And look for the definition of what constitutes construction activities in the REC contract, as well as section 6.2 for more information. The next item is on PLA, the Project Labor Agreement requirements. This is applicable for construction activities of the project that occurs after CEJA has been enacted, September 15, 2021. So if you begin construction activities after CEJA is enacted, you'll be required to comply with the PLA. You need to file your PLA with the director of the IPA 30 days of the execution of the PLA or the effective date of the project if it has already been an energized project, or 60 days prior to the start of the project's construction. So those are the timeline provided in the contract that mirrors what is more or less in CEJA as well. You will work to provide the IPA and file your PLA with the IPA in accordance with the procedures that are established. And there is just one thing that we do want to note pursuant to the 2022 long-term plan. The PLA itself has several elements. You can look at them at the definition of the PLA in the agreement that includes provisions for minorities and women as defined under the Business Enterprise for Minorities, Women and Persons with Disability Act. They will have these goals for apprenticeship hours to be performed by minorities and women, and these goals for total hours to be performed by underrepresented minorities and women. Through the long-term plan, you can comply, and this has been approved by the Commission, you can comply with these requirement by providing a description of the efforts that you will take or has taken to achieve these goals, including recruitment of minorities and women in apprenticeship roles. Take a look at the definition of project labor agreement in the contract as well as section 6.3 under the contract. Then we move to minimum equity standards requirement. This is applicable to projects that are not operational as of the contract execution. This is only applicable for delivery years for which construction activities are performed, starting on the contract effective date through the date of first operations of the project. So if the date of first operations has occurred, then this requirement is no longer applicable. And the requirement is simply 10%. It is fixed. It is fixed for the life of the contract where construction activities are taking place through the date of first operation. This 10% will not change. And when we say 10%, what we mean is 10% of your project workforce have to consist of these equity eligible persons or contractors. These terms are defined in the REC contract, and the requirement is fleshed out more in section 6.4 of the REC contract. There are three reports that you need to provide. There is a forward-looking compliance plan that is due at the beginning of each delivery year for which construction activities is expected to take place. This is due by July 15. And the first plan is actually due within 30 days of the bid approval by the Commission. There is a mid-year check-in. This is due by December 1st of each delivery year for which construction activities have taken place to let the IPA know that you're on track to meet your MES requirements. And then there is an end of year MES annual report that is due by July 15, succeeding the close of the delivery year for which construction activities have taken place, just to report how you have done during the delivery year and whether you have met the 10% or not. So additional information on this minimum equity standard and the larger umbrella policy known as the Equity Accountability System have been posted to our website. You can find that under the subheading Minimum Equity Standard Additional Information. The link is provided here on this slide 40 for you to take a look at. It's a new document, but it provides a lot of helpful information and guidance in terms of how to meet the minimum equity standard requirements. The slide here is the last slide we have on the contract. Just want to flesh out one item on the equity percentage requirement. This is a little different, but related to the MES in the sense that it deals with the equity standard requirements. This is an optional requirement. You don't need to propose an equity level greater than the minimum of 10%, but if you do, in order to qualify for a bid evaluation price reduction as described in our RFP, then you are subject to the commitments of this meeting this equity level during the term of the agreement. So this is fleshed out in section 2.5 of the REC agreement. This is independent of the MES requirements in section 6.4. This is measured a little differently from the MES as well. MES is measured on a delivery year by delivery year basis. If you opt to also have an equity level commitment above the MES, you are, in addition to 6.4, subject to the requirements of section 2.5, which will look at the entirety of the period for which construction activities have occurred all the way through the date of first operation and not for each delivery year separately. Failure to demonstrate fulfillment of this higher equity level will be an event of default. So just take note of that. Take a look at the definitions of how we define equity eligible contractor, equity eligible persons, the project workforce, what we define as construction activities, and please read the REC contract section 2.5 to familiarize yourself with the requirements before opting for a equity standard above the minimum 10%. And with that, I will turn the time now to Ms. Katie Olandi, who will walk us through the more practical aspects of our RFP process and post-bid contract execution process. Ms. Olandi? Ms. Olandi, you might be on mute.
Well, Ben, thanks a lot. I was taking back control of the slides here. So thanks a lot, Benjamin. So I'm going to start off this next section with the schedule for the RFP process. I'll then cover the steps to register for an account to submit a proposal for a project or multiple projects. I'm going to go through about five slides with screenshots. And then I'm going to start walking through the details of the qualification requirements and process. And in the last section, I'll discuss bid submission and evaluation. So the RFP process, it's going to kick off tomorrow with the opening of the Part 1 window, and then it'll proceed over the next 2 months. The qualification process is in two parts, as Ben explained, and the first part is the Part 1 proposal when bidders submit their qualification materials. The Part 1 proposal materials are due on the Part 1 date, that's Thursday, November 3rd. The bid participation fee of $500 is submitted as part of the Part 1 proposal and is therefore also due by this date. Applicants will be given time to cure any deficiencies and to respond to requests for additional information or clarifications from the procurement administrator. And then by November 17th, the Part 1 notification date, applicants are informed whether they have qualified to submit a Part 2 proposal. The Part 2 proposal includes posting bid assurance collateral with each of ComEd, Ameren, and MidAmerican in the form of cash or a letter of credit. And we're going to cover that requirement, including the required amounts, later in this section. The Part 2 window opens on Friday, November 18th, and closes on December 2nd. That's also a Friday. Applicants that have a successful Part 2 proposal can submit bids on the bid date, which is the following Friday, December 9th. And we're going to hold a training session on December 6th where qualified bidders can ask questions regarding completing and submitting the bid form. And you can practice all aspects that you would undertake on the actual bid date. Bids selected on the bid date will be subject to approval by the Illinois Commerce Commission. The ICC is expected to release its decision on the results of the RFP by Thursday, December 15th. So in order to submit a bid for a project in the RFP, a bidder must submit a proposal via the online proposal forms. So to register for an account to access the online proposal forms, please visit the procurement website ipa-energyrfp.com and fill out the qualification registration form under the Contact Us page. So you'll select index wind, solar, and brownfield category, provide the number of projects for which you intend to submit a proposal, and then submit the form to us. A separate proposal must be submitted for each project. So you're going to be given access to multiple online proposal forms through a single account. You'll also be asked to provide your name, company name, email address, and phone number. If you don't want to fill out the form online, alternatively, you can email us at illinois-rfp@nera.com with the same information requested here on the slide. And so I would encourage everyone on this call now that plans to participate to go ahead and request your accounts as soon as possible. We will issue one account per company, and the information to activate the account is going to be sent to the individual that registers. This individual is going to receive an email with account activation instructions from info@ipa-energyrfp.com, as you can see in the screenshot here. To activate the account, you'll click on Activate Account in the email body, and then you'll be taken to the proposal website and prompted to choose a secure password for your account. You must activate your account in order to access the forms. The individual that registers for the account is also going to receive an email from us with a guide with screenshots for how to complete the activation steps, and then how to complete the online form and pay the bid participation fee. So we're going to issue an account within 24 hours of receipt of your registration. Again, feel free to go ahead and register at this time. Once you have an account, you can access online forms to work on your proposal or proposals in two ways. You can go directly to the web address provided here, forms.ipa-energyrfp.com. Or you can access the website through the procurement website by clicking on the qualification form subpage in the indexed wind, solar, and brownfield section of the website, as shown here on the screenshot. If you're planning to qualify multiple projects, as I mentioned on an earlier slide, you're going to be required to submit a separate proposal for each project. And you'll do this by submitting a unique online proposal form for each project. So when you log into your account, you'll be able to toggle to the different forms by clicking on the icon in the top right-hand corner. And from the drop-down menu, you can select a project and access the Part 1 form dedicated to that project. So in the screenshot here, it's for a sample bidder that requested an account to submit proposals for four projects. The naming convention used to create each project level account is a short name for the entity plus a three-letter tag plus a number one through the number of accounts requested. So here, 1 to 4. This tag is used by us for organizational purposes only throughout the process. It's how we're going to identify the project and notices and other correspondence to you. So with that, we really do recommend that if you're submitting proposals for multiple projects, you create some sort of internal key on your end to help identify which number corresponds with which project. This way you always know which project you're working on in the form. And so, you know, when you log in to the form for a project, you can always identify which project you're editing by looking in the menu in the bottom right-hand corner, as shown in the green circle on this slide. So just two more quick slides on navigating the website. As you navigate through the form to complete each section, there will be additional fields that appear depending on your response to items and questions. So some sections that are specific to the category of the project will not display until an election has been made in section two, as you can see in this screenshot. So please be sure to answer each question as you move through the form to ensure that the form displays all required fields and uploads. Lastly, if you're submitting proposals for multiple projects, some information is only required to be submitted by the bidder once, and the form will clearly state this. This information that is applicable across all projects should be submitted with a single project, the first one for which a proposal is submitted. So with that, in this next section, I'm going to walk through the details of the qualification requirements and process. This slide provides some general information before I start discussing specific requirements for part one. For purposes of your proposal, the bidder is the entity that submits the proposal, and the seller is the entity that will sign the index rec contract if the project is selected. If there are multiple projects and sellers, then these entities are not required to be the same. And I'm going to provide some more information on naming the bidder and seller on the next slide. A part one proposal consists of information submitted through the online form, supporting documents that are uploaded to the online form, and inserts that are also uploaded. Supporting documents and inserts could also be emailed to us. So to clarify, inserts are documents that we provide to you in Word format that need to be filled in, and in some cases signed by an authorized individual. These inserts are posted to the procurement website. And for the part one proposal, they're grouped by category of project, wind, solar, or brownfield. So please be sure to download the appropriate zip file for your project. As I mentioned on the previous slide, the seller is the signatory to the index rec contract and the bidder is the entity submitting the proposal. And this slide provides some examples for naming these entities. If you are presenting a single project, the bidder and the seller must be the same entity. If you're presenting multiple projects with multiple sellers, we provide here a couple of examples for naming the bidder. One, you can use the parent entity as the bidder, as shown in the bottom box three. Or two, you can identify the bidder as a list of the seller names separated by a comma. So in box two, the seller in the first proposal is seller C, and the seller in the second proposal is seller D. And then in both proposals, the bidder is seller C, seller D. So once you start filling in the online proposal form, you'll be asked for a name of the project. You must also upfront confirm whether the project is operational as of the submission of the part one proposal. You'll then, in section one, provide contact information for the entities and authorized individuals. For the seller and the bidder, you'll be required to provide the exact legal name of the entity or entities and the address. You'll also name and provide contact information for an officer of the seller. This is the individual who will make all representations required in the part one proposal and the part two proposal for the seller. This individual must be empowered to undertake contracts and bind the seller. You'll also provide contact information for up to four representatives. Representatives are individuals that are authorized to act on behalf of both the bidder and the seller. These will be our main point of contact, and they'll receive all correspondence from us. They'll also be responsible for responding to requests for additional information. So you'll be asked to provide information for one representative in the online form, and then three additional representatives can be named by completing the representative insert. If you're submitting multiple projects, then all representatives must be the same across your projects. Lastly, in section one, if the seller is an equity eligible contractor, which is a business that is majority owned by equity eligible persons or EEPs, or a nonprofit or cooperative that is a majority owned by EEPs, or a natural person that is an EEP offering personal services as an independent contractor, then the bidder should indicate this, and then you'll need to provide documented evidence. So specifically, the bidder must provide the equity eligible contractor insert with information about the business structure of the seller and to identify the EEPs, and also an equity eligible person insert for each EEP with information about the individual and evidence of their qualified status as an equity eligible person. In the Part 1 proposal, you'll also provide basic information for your project, including the category, utility scale wind, solar, or brownfield, the system size in megawatts, AC rating, and the first date of operation, either actual or expected. Projects that started operations prior to June 1, 2017 are not eligible. Also, in Section 2, a bidder may submit evidence to support a higher capacity factor than 45% for utility scale wind or 30% for utility scale solar and brownfield. So these capacity factors on this slide, 45% and 30%, are used as an input to set the maximum annual quantity of RECs that a bidder can submit in their bid form. So the evidence that's required if a bidder does opt to support a higher capacity factor would include a forecast of energy production and relevant design specifications that support this higher capacity factor. So there are requirements for some projects related to project labor agreements in Section 2. If construction activities for the project began prior to September 15, 2021, this requirement does not apply to the project. But if construction activities have begun as of submission of the Part 1, but did not begin prior to September 15, 2021, then the bidder must provide evidence that the project labor agreements have been filed with the director of the IPA by email to ipa.pla@illinois.gov. Evidence that the IPA has determined that the project labor agreements for the project meet the requirements would be due with Part 2. If construction activities have not begun as of submission of the Part 1 proposal, then the seller must certify that the project will be built by general contractors that have entered into a project labor agreement prior to construction. And sellers must also acknowledge the requirements under the contracts and the terms and conditions as defined by the Project Labor Agreements Act. So if construction activities have begun for the project and they started on or after September 15th, please do not delay in submitting your project labor agreements to the IPA using the email address on this slide. In the Part 1 proposal, unless a project is already operational or the seller is an equity eligible contractor, the officer of the seller will be required to acknowledge the minimum equity standard of 10% will apply to the project and acknowledge that there are reporting requirements under the contract. As Ben mentioned, on an optional basis, in Section 3 of the Part 1 form, if construction activities for the project have not begun as of submission of the Part 1, the seller can commit to an equity level percent that's greater than the minimum equity standard of 10% in order to qualify for a bid evaluation price reduction that's described in the rules. So in order to qualify for the price reduction, the bidder must provide the following documentation. So first, the seller must provide additional certifications, which includes acknowledging the additional reporting requirements under Section 2.5 of the contract and the penalties should the seller fail to demonstrate that they met the higher equity level. The bidder must also provide a narrative plan that describes how the seller will meet the higher level commitment, including a communication plan for outreach and a projection of the number of workers, related to the construction activities up to the point of the date of first operation that the bidder expects to be within the workforce. And then the bidder must also provide letters of intent to negotiate or contract with contractors or subcontractors that employ EEPs or evidence of current employment of EEPs for 50% times the higher equity level percent commitment times the projected number of workers from the narrative plan. And so Appendix 14 to the rules includes minimum requirements related to the third bullet. So required information regarding the project site differs between utility scale wind and solar versus brownfield projects. This slide covers requirements only applicable to utility scale wind and utility scale solar. Applicants will provide the complete address for the project along with a map for the project site that clearly shows the location of the project. A project that's located in a state adjacent to Illinois and wishes to qualify on the basis of the public interest criteria in the Act must be pre-approved by the IPA to be eligible for Illinois RPS compliance. So currently on the IPA's website, there's an evaluation spreadsheet to be completed and submitted to the IPA for approval. If you have a project located in an adjacent state, please follow the link on this slide to download the spreadsheet that's dated August 15th, 2022. You'll complete the required fields as instructed in the spreadsheet, and then you can email that form to ipa.contactus@illinois.gov. The evaluation spreadsheet that's dated August 15th, 2022 has been updated in accordance with the 2022 long-term plan. And so that spreadsheet must be used to qualify projects for this fall 2022 REC procurement. This means if you submitted an earlier version of the spreadsheet and the project was approved, you must resubmit the information again using this updated version. This slide and the next two slides are going to pertain to qualifying a brownfield project site. So a brownfield site photovoltaic project must be located in Illinois. Applicants must provide the complete address for the project along with a map of the project site. Importantly, the project must be entirely contained within the brownfield site. And projects that are co-located with another facility on a greenfield site would be required to disclose this fact. So in particular, the project that's contained within the brownfield site will have a single dedicated meter and will have an account registered in PJM GATS or MRETS. The project site must fit into one of the two buckets from the definition under the Act. So the project site is either by the US EPA or Illinois EPA under one of the four programs in the Act, and I'm going to list them on the next slide, or the project site is located at the site of a coal mine that has permanently ceased coal production, permanently halted any remining operations, and is no longer accepting any coal combustion residues. This coal site has both completed all cleanup and remediation obligations under the Federal Surface Mining and Reclamation Act of 1977 and all applicable Illinois rules and other cleanup, remediation, or ongoing monitoring. The definition goes on to require demonstrated compliance with all applicable federal and state environmental rules and regulations. So this slide provides the four programs under which a brownfield site qualifying under the first bucket must be regulated. The table provides the applicable program on the left, and then a list of sufficient documentation that can be provided as evidence in the Part 1 form that the project is in fact regulated by that program on the right. The procurement administrator may consider other forms of documentation that you provide to demonstrate regulation as well. Any document that's submitted must be dated no earlier than 25 years prior to the bid date, which is December 9, 2022. And we note here that there are additional requirements for projects regulated by the IEPA site remediation program, and those additional requirements are listed in paragraph 4.5.5 of the RFP rules. For a project that's located at the site of a permanently closed coal mine, the bidder must certify as part of its Part 1 proposal that the coal mine has permanently ceased coal production, permanently halted any remining operations and is no longer accepting any coal combustion residues. And then to demonstrate that the project site meets the definition of the Act, a bidder must submit first a copy of the permits for coal mining operations, a copy of the Department of Natural Resources decision approving the permits, and then documented confirmation that reclamation phases 1, 2, and 3 have been completed for the project site by providing evidence that the entirety of the performance bond for the project site has been released. So sufficient evidence of performance bond release at the completion of phase 3 includes, but is not limited to, a screenshot of the Illinois mine permits map showing phase 3 status is released, or other documentation for us to review if appropriate. And notably, the permits provided must cover the project site, which may be a portion of the coal mine. With this slide here, we're back to discussing eligibility requirements that are applicable to all three categories. So in the Part 1 proposal, in Section 6 of the form, projects are required to meet a project maturity requirement. This can be accomplished by providing the documentation listed in the table from PJM, MISO, or a utility, or by demonstrating site control for a portion of the project site. So if you can provide a document from the table on the slide, you do not need to provide evidence of site control. And if you've not started the interconnection process, no problem. You can still qualify if you show documented evidence of site control for a portion of the site. So if the project's interconnecting with PJM, the applicant may provide the Q OASIS ID and a copy of the completed system impact study. If interconnecting with MISO, if the project is in the DPP 2020 cycle 1 or a later study cycle, please provide the project number and a copy of the preliminary system impact study under DPP 1. If interconnecting with MISO in an earlier study cycle, then you'll be asked to provide the project number and a copy of the fully executed interconnection agreement. If interconnecting with a utility, the fully executed interconnection agreement could be provided if available. So as I mentioned, if these documents are not available or if a document that shows the project is farther along in the process is not available, then you'll be required to describe the stage of development thus far for the project, and then demonstrate exclusive site control for a portion of the site. So in particular, to figure out how much site control is required, you can use this slide. You need to demonstrate site control for at least 40 acres times the project size for a utility scale wind project, at least 4 acres times the project size for a utility scale solar project, and at least 3 acres times the project size for a brownfield site photovoltaic project. The table on this slide here provides a list of acceptable documentation. So there are many types of documents that will be accepted, and this document could be different depending on the different landowners. That's not an issue. Also, if a document that you provide is a letter of intent or a memorandum of understanding, then it must satisfy specific minimum requirements, and those minimum requirements are provided in Appendix 4 to the RFP rules. So the seller will be required to make a number of certifications regarding the project and the seller. These certifications will be uploaded to Section 7 of the form. Examples are that the project meets the requirements in the rules. The project will have or has a single revenue quality meter. There's no substitution for another project, et cetera. In regards to the seller, the officer will accept the terms of the contract and will acknowledge the collateral requirements under the contract, for example. The seller must certify that seller, including its contractors and subcontractors rendering services under the index rec contract, will comply with the requirements of the Prevailing Wage Act. And projects that are not located in Illinois must demonstrate at minimum wage parity with the prevailing wage requirements in Illinois. Additionally, under the Act, a bidder and seller cannot be in violation of the Displaced Energy Workers Bill of Rights. And we provide a link to the Bill of Rights on this slide here, and it's provided under Section 10-25 of the Energy Community Reinvestment Act. This slide continues with the requirements in Sections 8 and 9 of the proposal. So if the seller or its guarantor is rated by one or more of the major rating agencies, then all available credit ratings must be provided. This information is used for a credit assessment under the contract, but no, it is not a requirement for the seller to be rated or to have a rated guarantor in order to participate in the RFP. In Section 9, the bidder provides evidence of payment of the $500 bid participation fee. It's required of all bidders that have not yet paid this fee in 2022. So if you participated in the spring 2022 Index REC RFP, for example, and paid this fee, then you would not be required to pay again this fall. If you plan to use a letter of credit to post financial guarantees under the Index REC contract, should you be a winner in the RFP, it's a good idea to start working with your financial institution now to get the documents in place in time. So you can download the two options for the post-bid letter of credit provided as exhibits to the contract, and then you can submit red lines with changes requested by your bank for review by the companies. You'd submit these red lines to us by email or upload to the Part 1 form in order to receive a review. There are preliminary lists of modifications that are already deemed acceptable by each company on the procurement website. If you submit a red line for review and a modification is accepted, then that modification would be added to a final list of modifications that can then be used by any bidder. So a bidder can also provide comments on or propose modifications to the standard pre-bid letter of credit for each company. The pre-bid letter of credit is an option to be used to meet the bid assurance collateral requirement that's due at the Part 2 proposal stage. So there are two versions of the standard pre-bid letter of credit for a company, and these two versions have different terms. There's an electronic version that accommodates transmission by the issuing bank by electronic means. Those are appendices 5-7 to the rules. And then there are hard copy versions that accommodate transmission by the issuing bank via overnight delivery service. Those are appendices 8-10. So depending on your issuing bank, you'll use one of these two versions. And each of the electronic versions and hard copy versions of the letters of credit have been posted in separate zip files for you on the website. Again, there are preliminary lists of modifications that are already acceptable to each company and posted to the website. These lists are also grouped by electronic version versus hard copy version. Again, if you submit a red line for review and your requested modification is accepted by the company, then that modification can be used by any bidder and will be added to the final list of modifications. So as I mentioned, some inserts to the Part 1 and Part 2 forms do require a signature. The officer of the seller must make all of the signatures for both parts of the proposal, the Part 1 proposal and the Part 2 proposal. The inserts required in both parts are already posted to the website, so they could actually be made at one time and submitted all together with the Part 1 for early processing if that's more convenient for your officer. Inserts may be printed, signed, scanned, and uploaded to the form, or they can be submitted with a digital signature produced by a software such as DocuSign or Adobe Sign. So electronic signatures, such as a picture signature, is not considered acceptable to complete the inserts. When you've completed your form for a project and you're ready to submit to us for review, you're going to click submit on the form, and then your proposal is evaluated promptly. So while we evaluate your proposal, you'll be temporarily locked out, and then we'll provide a notice back to you as soon as the evaluation is complete, and that notice will be either a complete notice or it will outline a detailed list of items to clarify or complete, and then you'll be provided with a deadline to respond. And generally, bidders are given until the part one date or two business days, whichever is later, to respond to a first request for additional information. And then the review process for part two will generally flow the same way. So the part one date when your part one proposal is due is November 3rd. And then the part one notification when you'll be informed whether you can submit a part two proposal is November 17th. One quick note on the form here, if you're submitting part one forms for multiple projects, then you can submit forms at different times. Any form that has not yet been submitted will remain open for editing. So in the screenshot on this slide, you can see the bidder has submitted the form for their first project and has been taken to the submission confirmation page. And now this project is in gray in the drop-down menu, but the other projects are still available to be edited. And so you can still select them. And so really what this means is you can complete a proposal for a project at different times. You don't have to wait until they're all completed to submit. So the components of the part one notification are listed on this slide. So if your project qualifies pursuant to a successful part one, you're going to get a letter notifying you of the qualified status, a customized bid form that'll be used for all of your projects, instructions for completing and submitting the bid form on the bid date, an invitation to training to practice bid submission procedures, confidential credentials for submission of the bid form, and also instructions for providing bid assurance collateral to the companies. If your project qualified, then you can begin submitting the part two proposals on the following day. So by the part two date on December 2nd, you must provide the first three bullets here. It's submitting more information through the online part two form, upload or email some additional certifications, and then submitting the bid assurance collateral to each of the companies. And the bids are part of the part two proposal, but they're not due until the bid date on December 9th. So specifically in the part two form, you're going to provide any updates to contact information. You're going to provide a preliminary RFP project percentage that's going to be used to calculate the amount of required bid assurance collateral, and I'll cover that on the next slide. You're going to elect the form of bid assurance collateral that will be provided, either cash or letters of credit. You're going to provide the information to prepare the contract should you have a project that has a winning bid approved by the commission. And lastly, you're going to provide an indicative quantity for the project. And the indicative quantity is an annual number of RECs that the applicant plans to bid, but it's non-binding at the point of submitting the online part two form. Also with the part two proposal, a bidder that provided evidence that the project labor agreements for a project were filed with the director of the IPA by email to ipa.pla@illinois.gov with the part one proposal will be required to submit evidence that the IPA has determined that the project labor agreements for the project meet the requirements under the IPA Act and the Project Labor Agreement Act. This slide provides the more information regarding the RFP project percentage. So a reminder or note that the RFP project percentage is defined in the index rec contract as the percentage of the project's actual production as offered by seller through the RFP and as indicated in the product order. This RFP project percentage in the contract cannot be amended throughout the term. This percentage is used as an input to establish the standing order for the project. So in the part two proposal, a bidder must provide a preliminary RFP project percentage that's rounded to two decimals This preliminary number is used for purposes of calculating the required bid assurance collateral due with part two. The final RFP project percentage for the project is provided later in the bid form. But a note up front here that the final must be equal to or less than the preliminary RFP project percentage that's provided for that project in part two. So it's the final RFP project percentage that's provided in the bid form that's used in the standing order. It's also used in the formula to calculate the maximum bid size, which is the maximum number of RECs on an annual basis that can be submitted in the bid. And it's this one that goes into the product order and cannot be changed. There's only one case where the project RFP project percentage can change after the bid window, and that's if the project is selected for a partial award, which would be an annual quantity of RECs that's less than the full quantity in the bid. So this slide provides the required bid assurance collateral amounts. The required amount is a function of the size of the project and the preliminary RFP project percentage, rounded up to the nearest $100, and it's subject to a ceiling. So the amounts provided here are on a per megawatt basis, and the ceilings applicable to each company are also provided on the right-hand side. So an example for how to calculate the bid assurance collateral for a wind project is provided here at the bottom. The bid assurance collateral required for a wind project that is 200 megawatts and indicates a preliminary RFP project percentage of 50% in the part two form would be for Ameren $160,000, which is the 1600 in the top left-hand square there, times 200 times 50%. Moving down in that column for Ameren, it would be for ComEd, it would be 400,000, which is 4,000 times 200 megawatts times 50%. And then for MidAmerican, it would be 40,000, which is 400 times 200 times the 50%. So as I've mentioned, the bid assurance collateral is submitted in the form of cash or a pre-bid letter of credit, and it's submitted separately to each company. If a bidder presents proposals for multiple projects, then such bidder can submit a single pre-bid letter of credit or effect a single wire transfer to a company in the amount for all projects. Importantly, if a bidder fails to provide bid assurance collateral to one or more of the companies, or if the bidder provides bid assurance collateral to all companies, but the amount for one or more companies is insufficient given the size of the projects and the preliminary RFP percentage, then the part two proposals for all bidders' projects would be considered deficient. I have one last slide here on bid assurance collateral requirements. So if you're submitting cash, you'll also be required to provide a W-9 for the entity to which cash will be returned. You'll also provide a draft request for return of cash, and there are samples of that request currently posted to the procurement website. You'll also provide a signed cash insert to acknowledge the conditions under which cash can be drawn. If you're submitting the pre-bid letter of credit for a company, your bank is going to use either the electronic versions or the hard copy versions. The electronic versions are appendices 5-7 on the website and must be submitted by electronic means. The hard copy versions are appendices 8-10 and must be submitted by overnight delivery. The pre-bid letter of credit for a company must be in the standard form or incorporate only modifications that are acceptable to that company and applicable specifically to either the electronic version or the hard copy version. And we're going to send very detailed instructions for submission of bid assurance collateral to qualified bidders or to bidders with qualified projects in the part one notification. So that concludes the overview of the qualification process. This next section is going to touch on the protocols for submitting bids and then the steps that are taken in the post-bid process. So the customized bid form that we provide to each bidder to use for all projects that qualify is the exclusive method for you to submit your bids. Bid forms are submitted through a secure bid transfer site on the bid date on December 9th during a bid window from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. noon. If the bid form is not completely filled out or is inconsistent with the rules, then it would not be evaluated on the bid date. But once the bid window closes, there is a cure deficiency period of an hour. We ask that you're available during this time. That way we can give you a call and you can remedy any issues before the cure period closes. We're going to provide to you a step-by-step guide with the Part 1 notification. And then everyone who qualifies does have the opportunity to practice the bid submission procedures during a training on December 6th. There's also a backup method by email to submit your bid form should you have technical issues with the secure transfer site on the bid date. So your bid will have three core elements. First, you provide the strike price for the project in dollar per megawatt hour. You provide a full quantity, and that represents the annual quantity of RECs the seller is offering to deliver. And then you'll also provide a minimum quantity that represents the minimum annual quantity of RECs the seller is willing to accept as a partial award. So a project may receive a partial award, so less than the full quantity, but never below the minimum quantity if that project is the marginal project selected during bid evaluation. And the marginal project is the project that, if selected, would mean exceeding the target for the category. So in the table on this slide here in the dark purple cells, the hypothetical 100 megawatt wind project is bidding to deliver an annual quantity of 150,000 RECs. The bidder inputted a minimum quantity that is less than the full quantity. So during bid evaluation, if the target left to fill is less than 150,000, the bidder is indicating that it would accept a partial award of no less than 130,000 RECs at the strike price of $100. So this means if the target left to fill is less than 130,000 RECs, then the project would not be selected. This slide provides additional bid form parameters that are inputted either by us or by the bidder. So first is the equity commitment cell. This is a cell that we will input. The equity commitment is NA if the MES of 10% is not applicable to the project. If the MES is applicable to the project, then the equity commitment is a value of 10%. Or a value greater than 10% if the seller did opt to commit to an equity level percentage for that project that's greater than the 10% minimum equity standard. So this parameter is put in the bid form to confirm the fact that the strike price for the project that committed to a percentage greater than 10% will be adjusted during the bid evaluation procedure. The next parameter in purple there is the final RFP project percentage, and this is inputted by the bidder. A reminder again that this final RFP project percentage must be less than or equal to the preliminary RFP project percentage to ensure that sufficient bid assurance collateral was posted for the project. It's going to be used to calculate the maximum bid size, which again is the maximum full quantity of RECs that can be submitted in the bid. And the final RFP project percentage in the bid form, again, cannot change once the bid window closes unless the project is selected for a partial award or an amount less than the full quantity. And then lastly, very importantly, in the bid form, you'll select an index hub that's either MISO Illinois hub or PJM Northern Illinois hub that corresponds to the bid for the project, and this is the hub that's used for purposes of payment under the contract for that project. And a reminder that you can select either hub regardless of where the project is being built. So the bid evaluation procedure is described here on this slide. It's going to proceed independently for each category: wind, solar, and brownfield. So the first step is that bids with strike prices that fail to meet or beat the benchmark for a category are eliminated. Next, bids in each category are ranked from lowest to highest in order of strike price, and the lowest strike price for each category is going to be used to adjust the strike price submitted for projects that committed to an equity level for the project that's greater than the minimum equity standard of 10%. So the adjustment is a reduction that's calculated as 1% times the lowest strike price submitted for that category times the ratio of the equity level for that project divided by 10%. So once strike prices have been adjusted, the bids are again ranked from low to high, incorporating those adjusted strike prices. And then in order of strike price, the full quantities of projects with the lowest prices are selected. And then in regards to the marginal project, as I've mentioned, the marginal project is selected for at least the minimum quantity or else the target is unfilled. So the final step is that projects with bids approved by the commission are then allocated to each company. And we're going to be issuing an Appendix 15 to the RFP rules. It's going to give an example of this evaluation procedure. So on the bid date, the procurement administrator expects to notify bidders by 6 p.m. CPT whether they have projects with a bid that will be identified as a winning bid to the Illinois Commerce Commission. At that time, if a bidder has not already provided the information to prepare the REC contracts with the proposal, that information must be sent to us. Within 2 business days of the bid date, the procurement administrator and the procurement monitor each submit a confidential report to the ICC on the results. And then within 2 business days of the receipt of the reports, the ICC decides whether to accept or reject the results. This final slide here discusses the next steps for winning projects. So once the commission renders its decision, each company is going to send partially executed contract documents to the seller. The seller then countersigns and sends back those documents electronically and fulfills the creditworthiness requirements under the contract. And we'll send instructions regarding these steps to bidders with qualified projects with the Part 1 notification. The collateral requirement under the Index Rec contract is due within 5 business days of approval of the results by the commission. And also payment of supplier fees to the IPA is due within 7 business days of approval of the results by the commission. So that completes the presentation portion of this presentation.